Welcome to episode 229 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be covering the opening weekend of the season in Les Trois Vallées, finding out about the new venue for the London Snow Show, and we're going to be taking a look at how to ski safely on the slopes and why that is important. Now, my name is Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. We have a full house as I'm joined by four guests. So firstly, I'm going to welcome Kimberly Kay and Dr. Carol Porter to the podcast. They've recently released a survey about how fear can affect skiers, and we're going to be discussing that in more detail later on. Hi, Kimberly. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good to be here, Ian. Thank you.
And where are you today, Kimberly?
I'm in Sheffield.
But I went up there relatively recently because I took my son to go and look at the university, and it's his kind of first choice. So I might be coming up to Sheffield on a more regular basis if he gets the grades that he wants to. Carol, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Good to be here.
And where are you?
I'm in glorious sunny Manchester.
It's sunny. Are you sure it's sunny? I believe it's not normally the typical weather there, right?
No, it's not sunny.
That's my daughter's first choice, so I may end up going up there as well. Right, let's come to Amy and Louise. Hi, the two of you are on one screen, so I'm going to address both of you at the same time. How are you guys going, and where are you today?
We're well, thank you. We are in sunny Morzine. It really is sunny here. It's a beautiful day.
Excellent. I'm really pleased to hear that. You're the co-founders of Peace Cross Code. We're going to be looking at that later on in the show. But a question I always like to start off with, and I'm going to start with yourselves, Amy and Louise, is when did you ski or snowboard last? Now, you are in Morzine. You said it's a sunny day. Tell me, when did you last ski?
Yeah, we've had two pre-winter weekends in Avoriaz. So I last skied on Sunday in Avoriaz. It opens officially on Friday, as does Leger and Morzine as well. So, yeah, I last skied on Sunday.
Excellent. That was Amy. Did you both go on the hill?
Yeah, I skied Sunday as well. I've skied the last three weekends, actually. I went to Teen opening weekend as well, and I've skied the last two weekends in Avoriaz. So.
Nice. Now, I was away last weekend, and we'll come to that later. During the course of the weekend, it snowed, but my observation was that kind of, you know, a bit lower down, below 2,000, the snow wasn't so good, but above that, it was great. How was it? You know, Avoriaz is 1,800, and I think the top point is around 2,400. So how was the snow over there?
It was great on Sunday. We had a great day. The kids loved it. There was fresh snow down to about, I would say, about 1,600 around Lindray. It wasn't too busy. Yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed it. It was a great day.
Oh, okay. Kimberly, when were you last on the snow?
Well, I was actually at Castleford at Snow Zone last week. It was my husband's return to skiing after doing his ACL last December. So it was a little bit tentative. But before that, of note, was 25th of April, end of last season, that dreamy deep powder, just dashed out to Val d'Isère and Teen to enjoy that.
Right, nice. I like the fact that you know the exact day as well. What about yourself, Carol, when you last on snow?
Well, I last skied last Friday. So I work as an instructor at Ski Rosendale in Lancashire, which is an artificial outdoor facility. So it's last on snow, real snow, was in Chamonix towards the end of last season.
Well, that was interesting, especially to hear about the snow in the Port du Soleil. We do have some snow reports that have been sent in by Bethany Garner from Verbier, Floss, who was on the podcast just recently from the Espace-Calais, and Tim over in the Dolomites. So let's have a listen to what they have to say.
Good morning, Ian. It's Bethany, and I'm sending in a snow report from Verbier in Switzerland. So I've been lucky enough to ski here this week. So we had some snow at the weekend, about maybe 20-25 centimetres, but it really did make a difference and it fell down to about 800 metres. But the biggest news is that it stayed cold, so it means the snow remains in really good condition and the resort are managing to make snow every day. So the pistes are in great condition. There's even some off-piste, there's a few rocks kind of poking out, but you know, for this time of year, it really is decent. So yeah, if you're gearing up for your pre-Christmas or your Christmas holidays, then we're in a good place. I think the higher altitude resorts, of course, are skiing better, and some of the lower ones probably need a little bit more snow so they can open their connections. But on the whole, yeah, good snow over here in Verbier, and thumbs up.
Hi, this is Floss from the Free Flow Floss YouTube ski channel, where I create snow forecasts and ski tutorials in Tiene and Val d'Isère. Now, last weekend, we received 25 to 30 centimetres of fresh snow above 2,500. Our avalanche level throughout this week has been a steady 3 out of 5. Fresh snow is still holding well in the gullies as we've had cold temperatures at mid-altitude. Now, the top depth of the snowpack is 80 centimetres above, and at low altitude, we've got 40 centimetres. Generally, all the pieces are in good condition at mid-altitude. However, the runs going into the resorts are very different with artificial snow. Today, we had 85 pieces out of 147 open, 22 out of 59 lifts open, and 85 out of 90% of all ski areas are open and ready for you to ride on. Now, it's very exciting times as the World Cup is here yet again in Val d'Isère for this weekend for the 69th time. Be safe out there and enjoy your riding.
Ian, buongiorno. How lovely to be back on the podcast, and we're looking forward to another season here in the Dolomites. My name's Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy, and I'm bringing you this report from Ortisè in the Val Gardena, specifically Café Valdana on the La Longia Piste, the home run into Ortisè. So, how are things looking in the Dolomites? Well, we've had a few days skiing already, and I can tell you that the slopes are in great condition. We got somewhere in the region of 311 lifts of the 450 lifts are operational. 800 kilometres of slopes are open of the 1,200. Looks like the east and the southeast side of the Dolomites is suffering a little bit, with Cortina, Araba, Marmolada and Civetta reporting fewer than half of their lifts open at the moment. Celeronda is open, but the Great Wall Tour currently closed. So all in all, I think we're pretty good for this time in the year. We did have some fresh snow on Sunday, but the forecast 30 to 40 centimetres turned out to be more like 3 to 5 centimetres. Bit disappointing, but there you go. No snow in the forecast at this moment in time, but the pistes are packed, but with that little bit of fresh snow from Sunday, skiing extremely well. The temperature is a little colder than normal, I would say, maybe the La Nina effect, and therefore a lot of snowmaking going on. We are looking forward to seeing you, Ian, in the Dolomites. I know you're coming here twice this year, so we're looking forward to catching up with you soon. Ciao!
And if you're starting to plan your skiing for this winter, I'm delighted to confirm that InSport are sponsoring the Ski Podcast again. That means all podcast listeners can save money on your ski hire by using the code SKIPODCAST at InSportRent.com. Or simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied at the checkout. Now, we have a little bit of news. In a Team GB update, I'm delighted to say that British snowboarder Mia Brooks is on red hot form. She is still only 17. She took her 6th World Cup podium, won in China in Big Air earlier this month. I believe it was a cab 1440. You can look that up on YouTube if you want to see what that looks like. We have over a year to go until the Winter Olympics in Milan Cortina, but she is looking like a great chance of a medal. So we will be following her progress closely. On the racing circuit, one comeback has started as Lindsay Vonn was back in action at Beaver Creek, but Marcel Hirscher's is over. Injury put an end to his season already. And this weekend, Floss referred to it, the slalom is going to be going ahead in Val d'Isère, and the British trio of Dave Riding, Laurie Taylor and Billy Major will all be racing out there. So we'll be following that as well. Don't forget, you can keep up to date with all the latest racing news with Matt Garker on the Skiing is Believing podcast. Now, if you listen to episode 227, that was my interview with ski journalist Lucy Aspden, you will have heard in the news section, it's been confirmed that the 2025 London Ski Show will be returning to its old home of Olympia. And I'm sure many listeners will have been to the show when it was there, because Olympia hosted the show for over 20 years. And earlier this week, I spoke to organiser James Gambrill to ask him about the switch. So let's have a listen to that. Hey, I'm delighted to be joined right now by James Gambrill, founder of the Mountain Trade Network. And regular listeners will know that I think it was episode 224 we last spoke. You just announced that you were taking over the London Ski Show. And the reason I wanted to have you on today is you've now announced where that show is going to be. And I think it's quite exciting. I wonder if you want to share the news with us, James.
Yeah, absolutely. No, good to be with you. And yes, it's been a busy few weeks and months since the announcement that Mountain Trade Network has acquired the show. Been busy looking at venues and very excited to say that the show is going to be held at Olympia in 2025. So going back to its home of 20 plus years.
Yeah, 20 years or so. I mean, I saw that in the press release and I kind of thought, wow, I wonder actually how many of those 20 years I went to. Because am I right in saying the last one was in 2010?
2010 was the last time the show was at Olympia. Yeah. And we haven't quite found exactly how long it was there before. It's at least 20 years. I think there has got a lot of suggestion it was there for more than 20 years. So from some point in the 80s through to kind of 2010, it seems to be the overall view. I definitely remember going to Olympia in 1992 when I was at uni.
I worked for Bladen Lions back in the day. I certainly worked at the show for Bladen Lions. And at that time, it was a 10-day show. It went over two weekends. I mean, it was so huge. But just to confirm then, so it's Olympia in West London. And what are the dates going to be for 2025 then?
So it is the 18th and 19th of October, so very similar dates to this year. So it's the weekend again, so Saturday and Sunday. Obviously, for exhibitors, Friday will be the setup, and then we'll open up to the public on Saturday morning, and it will run through Saturday and Sunday. So yes, not 10 days this year, but 2 days as it's been the last few years.
You know, most of our listeners are in the UK, and they're not all within reach of London. They might not know Olympia, but they probably do know if they've been listening to the podcast that in recent years it's been at Excel, which is over in East London. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it was great that there was a show there, but it feels to me that Olympia's a better venue. And
it's always difficult, right? There's not that many venues in London that can actually hold a show the size of the London Snow Show. You know, it's a big show. It needs up to sort of 10,000 square metres. There really aren't that many venues. Obviously, the show has been held in lots of locations over the years, including Earls Court, including Olympia, including Battersea Evolution, and most recently Excel. Earls Court is no more. It is now flats and apartments, so that's been removed. So, you know, there really aren't many places that you can hold it. And every venue has its pros and cons. The nice thing about Excel is it was much easier to get to with the Elizabeth Line extension going in there, and it is a blank canvas. You know, Excel is a 20 big boxes and you can kind of do anything with them. And I think it was a great home for the show, but certainly in talking to exhibitors, the feeling was a couple of things. People love having some kind of feeling of being outdoors, natural light, open space. You know, skiing and snowboarding are outdoor sports, and so it always felt maybe a little bit strange to be totally indoors. And you have got quite a few venues in London that have outdoor and indoor space. Now, realistically, it's London, it's October, the chances of rain are pretty high, and therefore the challenge of a show that's outdoors as well is when it rains or if it rains, you kind of got to make that work. So that's quite tricky. What I think is great about Olympia, apart from its history, it's a listed building. You've got these beautiful halls with this big curved glass roof. So it's completely weatherproof. You haven't got the complexities of it being outdoors, but you do get natural light. You know, if it's sunny, you feel that come through. So yes, you're indoors, but you've just got that sense of being a little bit more outdoors. And I think that's important for something like the show.
Yeah, and it's a very attractive space as well. And I think one of the things I like about it, and I saw the kind of plan for how it's going to look, is that you can use, there's a balcony that you can use as well, isn't there?
Yep, indeed, there is. And I agree. And Ian, as you know, we've both done lots of shows at Olympia. And I think somehow having those two levels and being able to go up and kind of look down on the sort of buzzing show below just added another element. It just added a kind of sense of a show, right? And this is a show. It's not just an exhibition. You know, it's a show. You go there to sort of, yes, to be informed, but also to be, you know, entertained. And I think the two levels really make a difference. And the balcony level allows you to do other things with it. Part of the refurbishment, the other reason to choose Olympia is there's a £1.3 billion refurbishment going on at Olympia at the moment. So the whole place is undergoing, you know, quite a transformation. It's a listed building, so it can't change that much, but they are upgrading everything, including changing that beautiful curved roof, which is quite a job. I think those two levels just make it a different atmosphere. So that plus the natural light and the refurbishment, I think, added up to a compelling package.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. And I think you're also going to have more of a focus on après-ski. Will we see any bands playing, for example, next year?
Yep. So there's going to be a central bar and there will be live bands. We haven't decided how many, definitely more than one, but there will be live bands playing. The idea of the bar is to make it feel as much as we can in West London like an Alpine bar. So we're talking to some of the most famous après-ski bars in the Alps at the moment about them kind of bringing their experience to London. So it will be a bar with a name you might recognise. And the bands that play in the Alps will be playing. So just, again, creating that kind of show, right? And creating that atmosphere of being, you know, in a ski resort, which I think amazingly the show used to do really well, despite being in London, you did have that kind of sense of I'm being transported to the mountains. That's what we really would like to try and create.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, back in the day, you and I were both involved in putting on events for season workers. And I think that if you have the après bands, then the season workers are likely to come along. And that adds to the atmosphere as well. What about one thing that I have loved about shows of the past? There have been snow slopes. I know you probably haven't settled on all of the, you know, the activities and the features that you're going to have yet, but might we see snow in there at all?
We might see snow. We haven't got plans for a snow slope at the moment. Obviously, we'd have to have a snow dome that wanted to do it. We don't have ready access to tons of snow, so there would have to be a local snow dome that was willing to do it. I'm not sure we'll have a snow slope for this year. We are looking at could there be any kind of snow features, but there'll be some different features in there. There will definitely be some family related features, and definitely things again to create that atmosphere. Early days, obviously, so we're still planning lots of things, but nothing is off the table as yet.
That's brilliant. I'm certainly excited about it. I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be heading along too. It's in 18th and 19th of October, not until 2025, but at Olympia. That's brilliant, James. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Ian.
So that was really interesting. I'm really looking forward to that show. Now, I mentioned I was out in the Three Valleys for the opening of the season there. Courchevel opened a limited area on Friday, followed by Mirabel and the opening of the Three Valleys links on Saturday. You can check out my snow report video on the Skipedia YouTube channel. The first couple of days were not perfect days on the mountain. They were kind of white out with high winds, but I did get to look at the new cabins for the Celia cable car, and that opens today, which is Thursday the 12th of December as we're recording. It's been closed since September 2021. The cabins are very impressive, beautifully designed. I spoke to Laundrie Tirard, who is head of ski for S3V, about them. So let's have a listen to that.
We're standing in one of the new cabins of the Celia cable car. I'm here with Laundrie Tirard, who is a ski lift manager for S3V, the lift company here in Courchevel. Hi, how are you?
Yes, fine.
Yeah, and excited about the impending opening of this new lift. I think today is the 6th of December. And it's going to officially open on the 12th of December, I think. Is that right?
Yes, it's right.
I think many listeners will remember that the old lift, you know, they'd be familiar with it. That closed in September 2021. There was some pre-season testing, you know, a fault was detected, and therefore they decided not to continue it. And you've just rebuilt the cabins entirely, and we're standing inside one of the cabins at the moment. Now, the old lift had a capacity of 160. What's the capacity here now?
The new capacity of cabin is 133. And it's a little bit less than the older.
But the dimensions of the cabin are the same, so probably that means there's a bit more space for everyone?
Yes, it will be more space for everyone inside. And the new cabin is more light, more we have a more panoramic view.
Yeah, you said about the light. I mean, that's very clear. If I look around here now, I mean, it's 360 degrees of light because the design has changed a little bit. There's much more glass in here than there was before. And you were saying to me that the use of glass rather than plexiglass means it's a little bit heavier, and that's why there's fewer people on board?
Yes, that's the reason, because we need to conserve the total weight of the cabin, a cabin with the passenger inside.
Yeah, so actually people are going to have more space. They're going to have better views. And what's the uplift capacity? How many people will it take per hour, let's say?
Yeah, the capacity will be 1,500 people per hour.
Cool. Well, it's very impressive. Unfortunately, I'm not going to get to try it on this trip, but I'll definitely come back and try it again. So the opening date is going to be the 12th of December.
Yeah, the 12th at 8 o'clock, and we start with the first track on the Combe of Celia.
Okay, so if you happen to be out there, then you know it's a day to get up early. That's brilliant, Laundrie. Merci bien.
Thank you.
Now I'm no lift expert, but if you want to listen to a lift expert, you can listen to my interview with Peter Landesman from Lift Blog. com in episode 121. But that new lift is really impressive. There's a kind of unwelcome cable car symmetry going on in Le Tourvalet, because as the Celia is opening again, the Seam de Caron cable car is in Val Thorens is currently out of action after a pre-season accident. I don't think that will open again. And that is probably much more significant than Celia, because there is no alternative way of getting up to the top. But I'll keep you updated. I'll put links in the show notes so you can find out about both lifts. There's a write-up of my trip on welovedski.com. I'll put a link to that as well. And I would just like to say a quick thank you to everyone who helped me put that trip together, especially Simon from White Storm in Courchevel, who sorted me out with a great pair of touring skis, and also Charlie and his team at the Grandjet Hotel in Mirabel, who helped me out with accommodation. Right. I would like to move on to Kimberly and Carol, if that's okay. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that you have released a study about how fear can affect skiers. And Kimberly, I wondered if you could just tell us, maybe perhaps summarise what you found from your study.
Yeah, we wanted to really understand about fear and anxiety affecting people's enjoyment of snow sports. We had a bit of a sort of hunch that this is a barrier. We're trying to remove these barriers. And so I worked with Carol, and we undertook some research. And basically the key findings were that 62% of our respondents said that fear or anxiety impact on their enjoyment of snow sports.
Okay, can I just ask a quick question? You said 62%. Was this specifically asking women respondents for their views on fear?
We actually launched, we did a two-pronged approach. So we did some quantitative research, which was an online survey. And whilst we listed a few things that we thought might impact fear and enjoyment, we also had some open-ended questions. That went out globally. We had responses from all territories. That's too much. That's really too much to handle. So we filtered down to women skiers from the UK.
And Kimberly, can I come back to you then? In those stats, you said fear or anxiety was impacting on their enjoyment of snow sports. I saw some numbers within that, the different types of things that people are concerned about. Have you got any data on that?
Yeah, so 69%, it was fear of risk of injury and re-injury, which kind of sounds a bit like a sort of no-brainer, really. But when you compare that to 41%, I said that it was fear of falling. So obviously there's a gap between fear of falling and the 69% risk of injury and re-injury. And I think that that really sort of then is indicative of the next point, which was 63% of people stated that other skiers and boarders' lack of control and speed were their concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably most people listening to the podcast would be able to relate to that, because I guess it's often said to kids who are learning to drive at the moment that it's the other people on the road that you need to worry about. And on the mountain, it often feels like it's the other people on the mountain that you need to worry about. People who, as you say, I think you said 63% of people are concerned about skiers and snowboarders skiing around with lack of control. And then another stat about the speed of other skiers and snowboarders. And evidently, the faster you go, the harder it is to control it. I wondered if you felt, maybe Carol, you could answer this, if that's affected at all, if there is a perceived increase in speed in other people due to the apps that people use these days. I've heard this theory before that people like to try and get the highest speed possible recorded on their app, and that might lead them to ski outside of their normal levels of control.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely a significant factor. You try to keep setting new PBs for your own top speed, and it's not always appropriate to do so.
And Kimberly, what do you plan to do then with the results? What are you hoping to do with the results from the survey?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things is to raise awareness that that one's own behaviour can impact on someone else's enjoyment. You know, you don't want to be a problem for someone else. So there's things that the individual can control, but then there's things that are environmental, which are things that maybe then the venues, the resorts, in their communication with customers, with displays, with messages about code of conduct, that's where those things can be impacted and affected by the industry, really. So there's sort of what you can control yourself, and then look into the industry to try and make a more safe and inclusive, you know, environment for everyone to be able to enjoy.
That is really interesting. It's not a coincidence that I invited Amy and Louise to be on the podcast for this episode as well, because I wondered if you wanted to, it seems like a really good opportunity to maybe give listeners an idea of what Peace Cross Code is and what prompted you to set that project up.
In 2022, there was a tragic accident in Flen whereby a five-year-old girl was hit and killed by a skier that was skiing too fast. It had a profound effect on the snow sports industry and especially parents locally. And for a long time, I have felt strongly that skiers, snowboarders, snow sports users in general have been skiing too fast and out of control. I'm also a physiotherapist, and I see a lot of people who've had accidents on the slopes, which weren't their fault. After the tragedy in Flen, I spoke to Amy, and we decided that something needed to be done. And within 2 weeks, we launched the Peace Cross Code, with the short-term goal to educate people better about the rules of the piste. The FIS code of conduct is out there, but we feel it's not visible enough and not known enough. And we were actually shocked when we launched the Peace Cross Code that even people that live in ski resorts weren't aware that there are actually rules of the piste. There is a code of conduct. So our short-term goal is to make people better educated and start behaving more respectfully on the piste to other skiers.
I did not know about that story, your founding story, but I think evidently it's interesting that not so many people, even people who live in ski resorts, know that there is, let's say, a code of conduct on the piste. Amy, how are you trying to increase awareness then? How are you deploying this information?
Well, we have a number of different platforms, and we're really well supported by the local community here in Morzine, and that is hopefully diffusing around the Alps now as well. So we launched a website and we projected our rules that we'd created, our updated version of the rules on the website. We've some strong social media campaigns as well. And that was kind of our first winter. We had a lot of momentum in that winter, which was really good for us, really inspiring. And then we created a animation because we started to believe that actually teaching children some of the more simplified rules of the piste was an effective way to create awareness for the rules of the piste at a younger age. So, but we've four children between us. They're all in ski school. They all ski brilliantly, as you'd imagine, because they've been skiing since they were about 2 years old. But teaching them the foundational rules of the piste and how to keep themselves safe became really important to us as well. So we created an animation. We worked with an award-winning animation studio and they created a video for us which portrays the rules in a way that's much more child-friendly.
I'll definitely put a link to that animation in the show notes. I think maybe at this point it might be useful, if it's feasible, to actually summarise, you know, what the rules, the code of conduct on the piste is. I mean, I probably think I have a rough idea of what they might be, but what do you think the main guidelines are that people ignore the most?
Well, most of them, actually. I think on a very simple basis, just checking the coast is clear before you set off. That's just your bread and butter. But so many people don't check. And whether that's that they've stopped at the side and they're starting, or that they're jumping onto the piste without looking. I think people skiing or snowboarding within their abilities in a controlled manner, with the ability to stop at any given time, is also key. There are way too many people that are either self-taught or simply don't care about how fast they go on easy piste, difficult piste, and that is the cause of a lot of accidents. I think we've added to the FIS code of conduct. You mentioned before about ski apps. We highly recommend that you don't use ski apps to challenge your speed unless you're in a race setting or a controlled environment. We also don't recommend listening to music because it obscures your ability to hear those that are coming from behind you. And alcohol consumption we've also added as not a good idea, because it's no different to driving a car. If you lose your inhibitions, you are more at risk to yourself and other people. We've also added about setting a good example to children. We, as Amy mentioned before, have been targeting children because we feel that if we set a good standard from the get-go, that will stay with them for life and also diffuse to parents and caregivers. But I think it's the parents' and responsibility to set a good example. When I'm on the chairlift with my children, I will point out hazards. I will always make sure they check the coast is clear. My children are young, and as much as I've drilled in the rules of the piece, they still don't necessarily have that forward thinking that adults do. Children can't anticipate hazards. So I think it's really key that the adults constantly remind them to check the coast is clear, to ski within control, to take a safe path. So yes, I think they're some of the main things.
I mean, lots of points that you raise there, which are very interesting. I mean, one of the things you said is stop at any time. Sadly, I have to report I've just been on a speed awareness course, which I did a couple of days ago, not on the piece, but on the motorways of the UK. And evidently, there is a braking time, which is affected by the how fast you're traveling. And so I think it's people understanding it, the same kind of principles apply. The faster you go, the longer it's going to take you to be able to stop. And skiing within control, as Kimberly observed earlier, is a big fear for people who are not skiing within control, and skiing too fast are a big fear for people on the slopes. Just out of interest, what is the formal right of way? I mean, evidently you should look behind you before you start. But I always felt that if you were higher up on the slope, then it's you who needs to take the responsibility to make sure that you're not being a dangerous skier.
Yeah, absolutely. And unsurprisingly, this was the element of the rules that people knew least about. This is the one that seems to surprise most people when they take our quiz on our website or something like that. The downhill skier always has right of way. So your responsibility to avoid the downhill skier or snowboarder. The person that is below you on the mountain, they can't see you. They don't have eyes in the back of their head. It's your responsibility to avoid them under every single circumstance.
Okay, Kimberly, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that there's something in that it's up to everyone to be safe and be seen. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I mean, I have a thing about white ski jackets. It's like, if you're on a mountain, a white ski jacket is just not a suitable colour. It's like trying to play football in green, you know, and I just think that, you know, so it is the responsibility of other people to enjoy, to avoid, you know, the individual, but we've got to make sure that we don't blend in.
Carol?
Yeah, and along with that, make it easy for the people behind to avoid you by being predictable. That's not helpful to anybody. You need to have a predictable rhythm and stay in your own corridor.
Yeah, I think that is definitely something you need to think about. You know, if you're the skier who is further up the mountain, it's fine to say that you need to watch out for everyone below. But if you have someone weaving all over the place, and I had this similar example when I was skiing last weekend, that someone who I thought was nowhere near me suddenly became right in front of me. And I don't think it was because I was skiing out of control or too fast, but these are factors as well. Kimberly, I wondered if I could bring the conversation back to your project slightly. Now, we've looked at, you know, how you can ski safely and how you can be safely on the piste and what kind of things people might be afraid of. But I wondered if there's like a gender factor in here as well, because a conversation I've had in recent podcasts, you might recall Nicole was on from Ski Moms in the USA recently, and it's a conversation I've had with Shemi Alcott as well, is that women often tend, when they have families, to, you know, draw back and maybe do less skiing. And I wondered if you felt that that was a factor within, came out within the research that you've been doing as well.
Yeah, I mean, our initial sort of reaches out to find out about ski fear were through social media posts. And so initially I did some illustrations and put those on Facebook and said, do you experience ski fear and anxiety? And the responses came thick and fast, and they were all women that were responding on this. And there was just one man. But yeah, basically the research backed up that women were a lot more likely to, for one, talk about it, for two, you know, evident in the responses to speak about it. And that's why then that became the data set that we really focused in on with the research. But it's interesting in conversations, like I said, I was in Val d'Isère end of April, when there was conversations about it, and myself and other women in the group started speaking about this subject. It was almost like when the men saw us speaking about it, then they started to open up about it a bit more. So I think that what we felt with the research is that not only are we focusing on this the female data set, we hope that by doing this research, we can basically open up this conversation more. Because if people don't express their fears, then how can an instructor or a coach or anyone in their group actually help them, you know, to support them to be able to, you know, to deal with it and mitigate it?
It's certainly a broader question as well that you're raising, Kimberly, about how perhaps men are less likely to admit that they have fears. And that's probably a broader societal question rather than one relating to the ski industry itself.
Yeah, and I think that when people are afraid, like, so if someone hasn't expressed that they're afraid or that they're tired, or maybe they then feel a bit bad for sort of implying that they're not as fit as everyone else, that's when they're possibly maybe less likely to put as many turns in, to be as, you know, adaptive and dynamic in the situation. And so that's when then they're more likely to, you know, take a straighter line. And this is when things can become dangerous, when people are tired, you know, when they maybe haven't sort of prepared enough, and they're kind of going beyond their sort of ability or their stamina. And that's when trying to be more mindful of how much you've skied and taking a break and stopping soon enough is really important.
Yeah, I think those things are really important. I don't know, Amy, Louise, is that actually come up in the code? You know, we've talked about skiing within your abilities, but considering the fatigue side of things, I know you mentioned alcohol.
Yeah, we think that alcohol is a really big issue, because now, you know, a huge part of people's ski holiday now, and this is a huge change I think that's happened in the last 10 years, is the presence of an après ski bar on the side of the slope for your home run, or at the bottom of a slope when you finish skiing for the day. People consume a lot of alcohol at lunchtime, and then they ski on, or they try to ski home beyond their ability. That is a big issue. And it's not to say people shouldn't, you know, have fun on their ski holidays. Of course they should. Everybody should do what they want on their holiday. But being aware of how much alcohol you've consumed, how your legs are feeling if you've had a tough day, you know, snow conditions at the end of the day, lots of moguls on that home run. We're huge advocates for the idea of taking the gondola down. You don't need to do that last run if you really don't feel like you want to, or you've got the legs for it.
I mean, I think those points are true absolutely for going down at the end of the day. A pointless truism is that if you're going to get injured, it's always going to be on your last run of the day. But I'm not sure about the alcohol side of things. I mean, I think people have been drinking alcohol and getting pretty drunk on the mountain for a long time. And maybe people are drinking less these days, although it might be hard to believe that if you look at the various folly deuces, et cetera, around. But for example, I'm very aware that if you look at like St. Anton, for example, where you've got the crazy kangaroo and the moosebird opposite each other near the bottom of the resort, that they regularly have had to deal with people getting injured coming down from there. So, you know, drinking in moderation, definitely a good idea. Amy and Louise, could you just remind me of the website address for Peace Cross Code?
Yeah, it's peacecrosscode.org. That's peacexcode.org.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'll put a link into the show notes for that as well.
There's some great resources on the websites as well if you want to encourage your ski group or your friends and family to learn more about the rules of the piste. We have an interactive quiz on the website that you can do. And if you pass the quiz, you then get awarded with a Peace Cross Code certificate at the end of it.
Excellent. That sounds like a really good activity. You know, if you think about taking your family out at Christmas, New Year, half term, etc., then to get on the website and do that would be a really good idea. Amy?
We have also been working with a foundation in the States called the Snow Angel Foundation. It was launched and is now run extensively by the Johnson family, Chauncey Johnson and his family, after his daughter was killed. You might have seen the posters, really hard-hitting posters of a snow angel We shared it on our social media a couple of weeks ago. The impact was incredible. And with the title is She Was Five, You Were Doing 50. His daughter Elise was hit by a speeding snowboarder. He was doing 50 miles an hour. And the snowboarder hit Shaunsey's wife, Kelly, and their daughter. Kelly had received catastrophic brain injuries. Her recovery was very, very, took a long time, but his daughter died. And so they've launched a campaign in the States as well, which encourages people, if they see bad behavior on the slopes, to make a contact with a person who is behaving dangerously, or if they suspect somebody is drunk or under the influence of drugs, to make that contact, because yeah, it is an issue, and it's not just an issue in the European Alps, is my point.
Okay, now well, that is really interesting. I'd like to thank all four of you for your contributions there in relation to slope safety and how people feel about it. And hopefully listeners will have taken something from that that will help them during their trips this winter. We're just going to move on to feedback now. I enjoy all feedback about the show. I'd like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please do contact me on social at Ski Podcast or email theskipodcast@gmail.com. Alexander Summers said the best ski podcast I've heard, which is kind of you, Alexander. Just Pat on Twitter said episode 226 was fantastic. That was about skiing in Hokkaido in Japan. He says I could listen to Mike for hours. He has total knowledge about skiing in Japan. He also has a fantastic Welsh accent as well. I love his voice. Lee Thompson said it's a really interesting podcast. There's something informative in every episode. I'd also like to thank Lee for buying me a coffee, as did Stir from the Snowheads Forum. Now, there are now 239 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. And believe it or not, 238 of those were listened to in the last week. This does happen from time to time. Normally, it means that there's someone out there who's discovered the Ski Podcast, is working their way through the back catalogue. So, listener, if that's you, I'd love to hear from you, particularly what you thought about those early episodes, which are over 7 years ago now, very different from the ones we have just now. You can catch up with our back catalogue too. There's loads to listen to back there. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you. I had a quick look in the last week. 61% of our listeners were in the UK, 19% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Vietnam, Congo, and Jamaica. Now, if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can follow us or subscribe. Just look for that button and press it now. Give us a review or leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and that helps other listeners to find us as well. Or you can book your ski hire with InSport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST. Or just take the link in the show notes and you will save money. You can follow me at Skipedia, the podcast at the Ski Podcast. But I would like to thank my guests for today. Kimberly, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Carol, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Amy and Louise on the same camera, thank you.
thanks for having us.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.